Ladies and gentlemen, joining us now is a man who's got a massive brain.
Mike Florio.
He used to be a lawyer, then he decided to take his talents to the internet.
NBC Sports.
I'm sorry I'm late. I was talking to Robert Kraft.
That isn't the time for an airing of grievances.
Pro Football Talk.
I got a lot of problems with you people. Now, you're going to hear about it.
Mike Florio with Bernstein, Holmes, and Rahimi on Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.
Let's talk some football with Mike Florio, shall we? I say we shall, because he joins us now on the Score Hotline that is presented by Circa Resort and Casino, CircaLasVegas.com, twitch.tv/Chicago670 to score. What's up, Mike?
Hey, how's it going?
Things are going well, Mike. I wanted to get your thoughts on what's going on between Tua and Brian Flores, because there's serious allegations that seem to have been taken seriously by Brian Flores.
I'm not surprised by the content of the criticisms that Tua lobbed at Flores. The timing seems a little off. Maybe he's emboldened now that he has his massive contract and he can open up and revisit things from years gone by. I know from 2021, right around now, there was a fever pitch of rumors that the Dolphins were going to trade for then Texans quarterback Deshaun Watson. That hovered over the Tua Brian Flores relationship, to the point where I heard at the time Tua was voted a captain for the Dolphins going into that season, and he declined it because he sensed this change coming, with Flores fixated, as people in the organization would say, on getting Deshaun Watson. That hovered over the team until the trade deadline, and then after that, all of a sudden, Tua started playing better. So the constant drip, drip of "you stink, you shouldn't be here, someone else should be here," i.e. Deshaun Watson, that didn't surprise me. When Tua went with the horrible person reference, or terrible person, excuse me, terrible, not horrible, it's horrible that I got it wrong, terrible person reference, that really seemed like a bridge too far. And I thought Flores handled everything very well yesterday. No cliche, no coach speak, very raw. At times he seemed rattled. At one point he seemed shaken, like he was going to break down, which shows you how much this really affected him. And he's looking inwardly at how he can make himself better. He said coaching is about correcting, and he's correcting himself. He didn't deny any of it. He didn't say Tua's wrong or Tua misperceived the relationship. It sounds like he essentially admitted what Tua was saying, and he's conscientious about trying to become a better coach as a result of it. So I think Flores handled it very well. And I can't wait to hear what Tua has to say when he next has a press conference and gets asked more questions about it, as he should be, because it really did seem like something that was a long time coming, and it was almost a little over the top.
Do you think that any of this, or at least Flores's behavior, could have had something to do with what was going on behind the scenes that ended up, you know, in a legal aspect in Miami when it came to just the way the team was being run behind the scenes?
Well, I guarantee you this, if and when there's ever testimony taken in the Brian Flores claims against the Dolphins, the league, and other teams, and it's still stuck on square one, 2.5 years later, on which claims will be arbitrated, which ones will be resolved in court. But if I'm representing the Dolphins, Tua Tagovailoa is one of the witnesses to come in and help me prove that Brian Flores was fired for reasons unrelated to the things he's alleged in his complaint, that this guy was crossing the line with how he was treating the quarterback, et cetera. That's how these cases get handled. But at a deeper level, two things. The Dolphins have been, for the most part, a dysfunctional mess since Stephen Ross bought the team. He doesn't live in Miami. He doesn't work in Miami. The people who are there without the boss present get into various turf battles and back and forth and undermining and blaming each other. And I just think Flores may have been under enough pressure that he was venting in the direction of the guy in front of him, the quarterback. And at the end of the day, Stephen Ross fired Brian Flores and wanted to throw Tua Tagovailoa overboard. Remember, he was trying to hire Sean Payton and trade for Tom Brady. That's what got them in trouble for tampering. So Tua was going to be gone right with Brian Flores after the 21 season.
How in flux is the kickoff rule?
Well, it depends on who you ask. And I asked the league about this. They had a preseason health and safety rule change conference call the other day. And I'm curious whether or not the owners, who are meeting next Tuesday to talk about private equity rules, and they have a kickoff discussion slash update on the agenda, could they move the touchback point from the 30 to the 35? Because I believe a lot of coaches are keeping their cards close to the vest on what they plan to do when the regular season rolls around. I think more than a few are just going to bang the ball out of the end zone and concede the 30. The average starting position is like the 28.3 or thereabouts with this new formation. Just make it the 30 and take the long return off the table. So the owners can change the rule if they want. The league said it's not likely that they'll do it next week, but they didn't rule out the possibility of tweaking the rule at some point down the road. Once the season starts, I think it's too late. You compromise and undermine the integrity of the season if you have different rules that apply to different games. Week one, week two, it's the 30. Then all of a sudden, week five, week six, it's the 35. That's not good for anybody. If they're ever going to do it, they need to do it before week one. And next Tuesday when they meet in Minnesota, that's their opportunity to understand where this is going to go. Teams are just going to give up the 30 and not get burned for a long touchdown. You move it to the 35, they may have no choice but to kick it off, put it in play, and take their chances on trying to tackle the guy who may go all the way.
Mike, how are the disgruntled receivers' situations similar and different?
The one big similarity is, when does the clock strike 12? And for the NFL, for these kinds of negotiations, and really in any industry premised on two sides with different positions having to come to an agreement, first they have to agree on when the deadline is. Now, I think the deadline should always be before the start of training camp, because you lose something if the player isn't there getting ready for the season. And how many times have we seen players who weren't part of camp, weren't part of the preseason, weren't around until a week before the first game that counts, they aren't the same guy that they were. So I think for all three of the guys that I've been watching, Brandon Ayuk of the 49ers, CeeDee Lamb of the Cowboys, and Ja'Marr Chase of the Bengals, that's a hold-in that hasn't been covered the way the others have been. I think we're looking at roughly a week or so from now. That's when the clock strikes 12. Get the deals done or not. I assume all three guys will get deals. They'll be in the fold, participating in the practices that will be held in advance of week one, and off we go. And the longer that it goes with Ayuk not being traded to the Steelers, I think it's more likely the 49ers are just waiting for that moment where the clock is chiming 12 times to make their final offer. Because if you do it before the deadline, what happens is you get squeezed off of it when the deadline comes.
It makes a lot of sense. And frankly, I think that's those three being disgruntled also set their own market and thusly set the receiver market for everybody else. I want to ask you about what's going on at Jets practice, because I feel like that's a daily saga. But I also am not sure what people were trying to clarify. I know Robert Saleh invoked the name of the Junction Boys. Aaron Rodgers said it was harder. I'm not real sure what anybody's getting at here, but I figured it's something to discuss.
Well, before the 2011 CBA, there were two-a-days and more padded practices and more intense off-season workouts. Part of what the owners gave up to get the Players Association to agree to significantly altered financial terms was the intensity, the frequency of these practices that can make training camp harder. Within the confines of those rules, Robert Saleh has decided to make training camp harder this year. And the idea is, and this is a Jim Harbaugh thing, he talks about the callus that you want to build up so that you can withstand the grind of the regular season. Now, along the way, you might get injured, but the thinking is you'll be more prepared for that physical demand. And look at what the Jets have. They have three games 10 days apart between September 9 and the 19th. They're going to play three times at San Francisco, at Tennessee, and then a Thursday night game against the Patriots. And when Aaron Rodgers, was talking about this yesterday, he explained that that's the theory. And then he throws in this gratuitous, you know, some people might disagree with that. I don't know why you go there. You're the leader of the team. Don't equivocate. Don't hedge. You got to be all in with what the coach is doing, because the players are going to hear that and they're going to think, well, maybe Aaron Rodgers disagrees with it. Maybe I should disagree with it. Maybe there's a better way to do it. Maybe he is working us too hard. They all need to be rowing the boat in the same direction at this point. Once the coach decides, that's what they're going to do.
Mike, I thought one of the most interesting things about Hard Knocks last night was watching Matt Eberflus talk about the joint practice. And he laid out like a clear guideline saying, look, we're not going to be fighting in this practice. If you want to fight, you will be conditioning for the rest of practice. How do coaches feel about, like, what's the value that you're hearing about joint practices? And do you know if any of the other coaches set clear guidelines and expectations when it comes to what your conduct needs to be like in those situations?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, the coaches of the two teams involved need to truly trust each other that the players aren't going to cross the line. And the league this year has gotten involved in policing it, which was overdue. The Lions and the Giants got fined $200,000 each for multiple fights over 2 days of joint practices. Usually that second day is the problem, because after the first day, the players go back to the meeting room and they get ripped when they look at the film as to how they got beat by the guy that they faced from the other team. So there are scores to settle the next day when they get together again. That's part of the risk. So however you handle it, however you send that message, if you're a coach. Now, part of you wants to see the fire flash from time to time. You could argue it's harder to put the fire there than it is to control the fire, but you got to be able to control the fire, especially now that the NFL is ready to impose discipline on teams that cross the line. You don't want to get a guy injured. You don't want to be stupid. You don't want to be doing reckless things. Remember Aaron Donald swinging that Bengals helmet a couple of years ago and got no punishment at all from the Rams other than maybe a talking to and a request that he not do it again. It needs to be taken more seriously because somebody's going to get hurt during one of these things. But the key is you want to get the work now that the preseason is three games, on the way to two, on the way to one, on the way to none. These joint practices are important, but you can't have guys crossing the line.
Caleb Williams, Jaden Daniels, Drake May, Bo Nix. I might be leaving some off, but there are rookies in this quarterback class to this point performing and looking like they belong. Is anything meaningful over the large sample of this preseason success?
Well, I think it was obvious from the get-go both Caleb Williams and Jaden Daniels would be week one starters. In fact, when I saw the announcement the other day from the Commanders that Daniels would be the starter, I thought maybe it got caught up in a glitch somewhere in the matrix. This is news, but apparently it was. They didn't tell us what we already assumed to be the truth. I think Drake May is still in a position where he's got some work to do. I don't think they're quite ready yet, and I don't think they want to throw him to the wolves prematurely. I think Bo Nix will be playing. The great unknown in Atlanta is Michael Penix Jr. For whatever reason, they've decided they don't need to see any more from him in preseason. Well, he needs those reps if he's not going to be playing. It just makes me wonder what they have up their sleeve if they felt compelled to put him on ice for two preseason games.
Sounds like he's playing is what it sounds like.
Well, I think that this is the perfect way, because usually when you put a rookie quarterback out there, there's no going back. You can't bench him. Then you get into a situation where you're messing with his head. He's having his confidence shattered. What they could do with Penix, they could say, and I don't know what they're going to do, and I don't think they know what they're going to do. But what they could do with Penix is say, Kirk Cousins really isn't ready. We're going to let Penix play until Kirk is ready. And then you know what happens? If Penix struggles, it's not we're benching Penix. Kirk is ready. And if Penix plays well, Penix just keeps on playing. It's the old 100% rule that we usually see happen during the season. They could say Kirk is going to play when he's 100%, and he just won't be 100% until they feel like they need to get Penix out of the fray. But the owner, I believe, in Atlanta is very instrumental in this quiet push to put the guy on the field. I mean, you made him the eighth overall pick in the draft. So I just think it's very odd that you're not going to give Michael Penix Jr. two games to get reps when presumably he's going to be put on the bench when week one rolls around. It just doesn't make sense. Just like making him the eighth overall pick didn't make sense. So maybe the final decision they make won't make sense either.
I present two things, Mike. Number one, I think they're afraid of injuries and that's why they don't want to play him. I know we just talked about it earlier in the segment, but I feel like that's the case. And number two, if there was ever a sign that I knew Ryan Pace had more power in that front office than we all thought he may have initially, it was that move, because we've seen echoes of it here before. And lo and behold, what happens? He gets a promotion. I can't wait until I find out he's the shadow GM, because that's the only way any of this makes any sense.
Well, I mean, one of the criticisms of the Falcons, based upon the various decisions they made this year, where is the strategic thinking? Where does this all tie together into a common thread that actually makes sense? Giving Kirk Cousins $100 million fully guaranteed as a practical matter and then drafting Penix doesn't make sense. Not letting Penix play in these games where he would be getting reps and on the shelf until next year, in theory, doesn't make sense. People think it's going to be 2 or 3 years for Cousins. I think it could be as short as one. And who knows what's going to happen by the time week one rolls around. It's hard for the rational mind, and most of the time I'd like to think I have one, to predict the actions of the irrational. And the Falcons have been irrational as it comes to their quarterback throughout this offseason.
It's a with Ryan Pace special. Sorry, Lawrence, I'm still annoyed.
With some of the injuries that the Steelers have up front, who makes the most sense to start at quarterback?
Oh, without question, it's Justin Fields. Look, I watched all of the preseason game on Saturday night, and Russell Wilson deserves credit for putting himself out there after he'd missed a lot of time with the calf injury. But when I see Russell Wilson, I want to see whether he's Seahawks or Broncos Russell Wilson. And he looked like Broncos Russell Wilson on Saturday night. Justin Fields brings a level of anticipation and excitement to the Steelers offense that they haven't had since Ben Roethlisberger had his mobility to extend plays, which has been a pretty long time when you consider how every year is a different reality for NFL teams. So it feels like forever since the Steelers have had an exciting offense. Fields gives them more excitement. And if you're going to have an offensive line that isn't as good as it needs to be, and if you're going to be missing Jaylen Warren, who I think is their best running back, who has burst acceleration and explosion, if he's going to be out and he's got a hamstring injury from Saturday night, Fields is the guy in your backfield that gives you that element that Jaylen Warren otherwise would. And I thought Fields looked great. I mean, he had a wide open touchdown, and the guy looked like he was shot out of a cannon to jump up and get it, and he still overthrew him. But then two plays later, he makes a great rollout and threads a needle on the sideline. So there's a little bit of an erratic quality to the Fields passing game, which you guys know well, but the legs, the mobility. If Russell Wilson can't bring that to the table behind an offensive line that isn't getting it done, you got to go with Justin Fields.
Mike Florio, thanks as always. We'll talk next week.
All right, see you.